From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
You're listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on Chinese foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center located here in Beijing. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host. We're coming to you today from the margins of the 5th Annual Tsinghua World Peace Forum, taking place on July 16th and 17th in Beijing. At the inaugural session in 2012, then-Vice President Xi Jinping gave the keynote address, which helped to secure the forum's status as one of China's most important high-level international security and global affairs conferences. Each year, the forum attracts Chinese leaders, military, defense officials, and leading international experts and former heads of state from around the world. One of the distinguished guests participating in the forum this year is Elizabeth Economy, the C.V. Starr Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The Carnegie Tsinghua Center invited her this year to participate in the Carnegie Tsinghua panel on U.S.-China relations this year in the World Peace Forum. And Liz, we're delighted to have you here with us to participate in the forum. Thank you very much.
That's a great pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
You know, in the days leading up to the World Peace Forum, of course, we've seen significant developments in the regional security area. We've had, of course, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague announced its rulings between China and the Philippines over the South China Sea. We've had the announcement of the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System, THAAD, by the end of 2017. Did you coordinate all these events to make your visit to China more interesting?
I just wanted to bring a little excitement to your life here, Paul, in Beijing. Yes, exactly right.
In all seriousness, I do want to start out with the topic that's on everyone's mind, of course, which is the Court of Arbitration's ruling in The Hague. Based on China's rhetoric and their public relations efforts in the lead up to the award, it seemed clear that no matter what was decided, they were not going to be persuaded that their claims were not legitimate. Looking at it in the near term, how do you see, is there a way to avoid an escalation of tensions and confrontation? Are there off-ramps, possibilities for off-ramps? How do you see the situation now?
Right. Well, I think certainly in the immediate aftermath of the award, the Chinese government's response has been pretty much true to form in the sense that they have, you know, rejected the validity of the award. They've referred to the court, you know, as a puppet court controlled by external forces. And they've even held out the, you know, threat potentially of, you know, calling for an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea.
If their security is threatened.
Right, if their security is threatened.
Sure.
You know, on the other hand, quietly they've said to the United States that they will practice restraint.
Hmm.
I think the Philippines has behaved admirably has had a pretty quiet response to their victory. And they're looking now to send a high-level representative to Beijing to try to move forward, right, to try to find a path out of this. You know, I think if you're looking for off-ramps, as you mentioned, I think there are probably a number of stages that you could think about, right? In the beginning, some easy early steps, things that the Chinese have raised themselves before, you know, cooperation on environmental protection, marine protection. I think, you know, another stage might be looking to joint development, you know, fisheries exploitation or, you know, oil and gas, if there are any reserves in that area. And then the third stage, and the most difficult one, would be trying to develop some kind of reduction of tensions, you know, both on the Scarborough Shoal and the Second Thomas Shoal. So I think, you know, if the Chinese are interested, and I think there is some interest there, in ratcheting down tensions but not losing face, there are ways for them to do it.
And in your interactions this week, that's been your sense, that they're ultimately over the long term, they're not looking for confrontation, but they care very much about these sovereignty issues, obviously. But ultimately, your sense this week is that there may be some possibilities for moving this to a better place.
Right. I think Right, based on a few discussions with some scholars, you know, there's a range of opinions certainly here, and I think that's probably true, you know, within the government itself as well. There's a range of opinions. But I think everybody's interested in de-escalating tensions. Yeah. Nobody wants there to be, you know, some form of an accident that sort of bursts into something more.
And how about the U.S. response to date? And, you know, how have you seen that? What do you suggest? I mean, in terms of a U.S. role, what would be most useful going forward? How should the U.S. be thinking about this?
Well, I think the United States should continue to do what it's been doing, right, which is to say that it, you know, takes no position on the sovereignty claims themselves. You know, it is obviously supporting the strengthening of capacity of countries like the Philippines and Vietnam in various ways, you know, to, you know, protect themselves from maritime domain enhancement. But other countries are also involved, and I think that's critical. So I think, you know, the fact that Japan, Australia, India, a lot of other countries are engaged in sort of South China Sea issues is important, because we don't want this to be seen as a bilateral conflict between the United States and China. And anything we can do to reduce the sense of that, I think, is very important to take it out of the competitive framework. I also think that in some respects, the role of the United States should be diminished at this point, because what you really want is to have countries that are party to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea to be the ones to step forward and say, okay, we'd like to see, you know, China adhere to UNCLOS. We're not party to it. We don't really have much credibility on that front, but a lot of other countries are. So I think there's some opportunity there as well.
Does it give any momentum in the U.S. for potentially joining, ratifying?
I think that at this very particular point in time, UNCLOS is going to be the furthest thing from the mind of President Obama and Congress. Yeah. He's got so many other things on his plate right now. But I think it's another indication for the next president that this is something we really ought to be moving forward on.
I agree. And then more longer term, I mean, how does the international community, the U.S., other countries in the region, ultimately, is it possible to persuade China to buy into this rules-based order that we see in the region? Can we get them to live with the current status quo and see it in their interest to halt some of the advancements that they've made to date?
You know, I think it is. You know, at various points, again, they themselves have said, okay, now we've done enough, right? We've built up enough. And so I think there have been points at which they've said, all right, we kind of have gotten a lot of what we've wanted, right? There's still more to be had. But I think there is sympathy, there is understanding, certainly within parts of the Chinese government, that this, you know, really assertive posture is undermining a lot of the positive energy that they also develop through all the good things that they do with regard to the, you know, regional economy, for example. I think, you know, there are certainly elements within the Chinese government that would like to, I think, ratchet things down.
Let me shift gears, if I could, because another sort of regional issue, which obviously is important and we've had important developments with regard to it, is the issue of Taiwan and the recent election of Tsai Ing-wen. In April, you visited as part of a Council on Foreign Relations delegation. You met with the leaders of both KMT and DPP, and I assume you met with the president-elect at that time. Could I just ask what some of your takeaways were from the trip? How do you foresee cross-strait ties proceeding under the new president of Taiwan?
Sure. So, yes, we were able to meet with both President Ma Ying-jeou and President-elect Tsai Ing-wen, as well as a range of other senior KMT and DPP soon-to-be leaders. You know, my sense was for President Ma and the KMT, you know, what really mattered was that the legacy of sort of peace and stability across the straits, as well as the sort of burgeoning economic ties that have been developed over the past 8 years, that these were not rolled back, right? That, you know, to the extent that really, the Taiwan issue was off of the, you know, flashpoint sort of agenda for the United States and China and Taiwan, that it stayed off.
Right.
And that, I think, really was an accomplishment. And and I think they wanted their legacy to continue. I think for President-elect Tsai, what I took away from our meeting with her was really her focus was overwhelmingly domestic. Mm-hmm. You know, what she was really interested in was rejuvenating the Taiwanese economy, right? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do to get young people jobs? How are they going to take care of the aging population, mm-hmm. the sort of social welfare net pension system? There are a lot of creative ideas floating yeah. around in our discussion there. And she wants peace and stability mm-hmm. As well. Yeah. I think you can see from the comments that she, you know, made in the lead up to her inauguration, her speech, and everything she's done since, you know, none of that has been designed to cause tensions sure. With Beijing. Right. I think she's done everything she can to mm-hmm. balance, you know, her domestic pressures and constituencies right. With the knowledge of, you know, you have Beijing sitting, right. You know, not too far away. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge has been, frankly, the mainland.
Right.
And I think it's unfortunate, but I think the mainland has taken a number of steps, you know, mm-hmm. most significantly, of course, stopping, you know, diplomatic engagement with Taiwan,
right.
But also recognizing Gambia. And we happened to be there at the very time when there was the issue of the repatriation of Taiwanese citizens from Kenya.
Right.
And we were in a meeting with one of the senior officials who was trying to deal with this issue, and he couldn't get his Chinese colleague on the phone.
Mm.
And, you know, to me, that just suggests that, yeah. right, that China was not doing anything to mm-hmm. make it easy,
mm-hmm.
right? And the real issue, and I'm not sure that the Chinese PRC government appreciates this, is that, you know, again, they're undermining Meng Zhou's legacy here.
Right.
Right, and right. alienating the Taiwanese people further.
Right.
And, you know, long term, what they're doing is so detrimental to their mm-hmm. interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is sort of, they're putting short term pain
right.
on the Taiwanese, on the DPP, and, you know, going to earn even yeah. longer term pain.
Yeah. At some point, my sense is the same as yours. I mean, I was China director for 2 years in the NSC. My first year was when Chen Shui-bian was president, and the second year was when Meng Zhou was president. And there was a huge difference, as you might imagine. And my sense is that, you know, Chen Shui-bian was, you could call him a revolutionary. I mean, he had independence in mind, and he was pushing it often. I get the sense, and you've met her recently, that Tsai Ing-wen, as you've sort of described, is more pragmatic and is not necessarily wanting to push the envelope on the issues that Chen Shui-bian did. Do you think that over time the Chinese will see that? Do they understand that she's more pragmatic? Was it an issue of expectations for them, that they had too high of expectations for her, that she would be able to accept the 1992 consensus? I mean, why are we in this situation now where they've cut off diplomatic relations and have put it in sort of the current situation that it is?
You know, I don't think that they had expectations that she would accept the 1992 consensus. My sense is that they consider her current behavior, her current actions to be tactical in nature, that secretly mm-hmm. she is Chen Shui-bian.
Distrust.
There's very deep distrust mm-hmm. of her.
And the party, the DPP.
Right, and the DPP yeah. as a whole, but really yeah. of her in particular.
Interesting.
And so they don't trust what she's doing now.
Mm-hmm.
They think, you know, over the long term, she will start to push the envelope. And so they're looking to have her, you know, sign on to the 1992 consensus, right, to mm-hmm. affirm it, because they think that that will be a marker that, okay, now we can trust her.
I see.
But I don't think the expectations were high that she would do it.
Mm, interesting. Well, before we let you go, we definitely want to talk about the issue of U.S.-China relations. It's the issue of your panel today here at the World Peace Forum, and specifically looking at the Obama administration over the last 7+ years. We're coming up to the end of the Obama administration, and we want to look at what his legacy on China is. I know your work at the Council on Foreign Relations has also been examining the legacy of Obama's rebalance to Asia, what some people refer to as the pivot. How would you assess the legacy of the Obama administration? Give us a sneak preview of what you're going to say today, and the rebalance to Asia. And what's your outlook going forward for U.S.-China in the next administration?
I think in terms of President Obama's legacy, I think the most important element of that is clearly the rebalance itself or,
right.
or the pivot, because I do think it is a fundamental assertion of U.S. values and freedom of navigation, free trade, and democracy, or good governance, if you prefer. And I think the strengthening of our alliances, the development of new partnerships with countries like Vietnam and India, I think really speaks to an appreciation within the region for what President Obama has made America stand for. I think it's been, I think he's done a really great job. And I think the energy that has come, again, in the region, right, to try to constrain assertive behavior has been really important, right? So it's not just about the United States and China, that you have all these other countries now engaged, a number of rising powers within the region. And I attribute a lot of that also to President Obama. I think the administration has been quite encouraging of that kind of effort. I think on the sort of, you know, U.S.-China relationship, go ahead.
Can I push you a little bit on the rebalance? Just a couple my own personal concerns.
Sure.
Did you get the sense, I mean, because I was here in China, of course, living when the rebalance was announced, and I agree with you. The points, the elements that you describe are very important, the allies and building partnerships in the region. There was, it was announced in a fairly dramatic way, which brought a lot of attention, and at the time it was led really with a security effort. And in China, of course, it was seen reinforced views that ultimately were trying to keep China down or contain China. Do you think that those elements that I've described have had a negative impact on their ability to sort of carry out the rebalance? And how will it affect it going forward?
I don't think that China's response has had a negative impact on the U.S. ability to carry out the rebalance. I think, you know, we are clearly moving forward on the security front in a very robust manner. I think with the Trans-Pacific Partnership on the economic front, you know, we've gotten to a point where it needs to be ratified. That's going to be somewhat problematic unless it gets done in the lame duck period. And I think in the good governance, you know, that's always sort of lower profile, longer term. You don't necessarily see all the results, but I know we're very active in, you know, Myanmar and in other others of the Asian developing countries in really important ways. So, you know, did it cause a stir in China? Did they think, as you're suggesting, that we were trying to contain them? Absolutely. And let's face it, part of the pivot rebalance was a response to Chinese assertive behavior. It's not clear to me that there would have been a pivot or rebalance had the region itself not called for the United States to become more deeply engaged, again, in part because of more assertive Chinese behavior.
And countries in the region asking us to
be there. So I'm not terribly concerned about how the Chinese look at it, because I think they're partially responsible for the very existence of the pivot and the rebalance.
And the one other issue that I worry about sometimes is that it's announced in an era of dwindling resources, at a time when we can't really seem to extract ourselves from the Middle East or Ukraine and other problems around the world. And how does that impact our ability to carry it out? I mean, in your view, the resource issue and just what's happening in the rest of the world.
Right. I mean, no doubt it makes it more difficult, complicates matters. But I think we've made progress along the way. We haven't not fulfilled part of our commitment. There is more to be done. We have to fully realize the pivot and rebalance in the next administration. But I think it certainly represents a step up from the previous administration's commitment to the region as a whole in this regard.
You know, I would agree with you that the elements are the right elements. My own view is, you know, we haven't, in the past, whenever we've adjusted our presence in the region, we just sort of did it. My one concern, another concern I have, is that if you announce it in such a dramatic way, it puts all the attention on whether or not we can carry it out, as opposed to what the principles should be for countries to behave in the region. And we've sort of taken our eye off that a little bit, and people really focused on whether or not the U.S. can carry out the pivot. Mike, I'm concerned about the TPP, as you said, because if we're not able to pass the TPP in the lame duck, I think it gets harder after that. And if we're not able to carry out the TPP, I don't know how we can claim victory on the rebalancing that was announced in the Obama administration.
Right. I mean, I agree with you. It will be a significant hit to our credibility. But there's no way that you do a trade agreement quietly. I mean, a trade agreement effort, you know, has to be pushed and announced and required an enormous effort on the part of, you know, Mike Froman and his team. I mean, and that's just, you know, ongoing, you know, negotiation after negotiation. There's nothing sort of low-key about that process. I mean, sure. You can see that with every trade agreement that we've pushed, whether NAFTA or CORUS or whatever it is. I think there's another element, though, to the sort of announcement aspect of the pivot and rebalance, and that is that, you know, we were coming out of the financial crisis, right? And it was a period of time really when the Chinese government was feeling, you know, sowing its own oats, right? And I think feeling as though, you know, China was rise, the U.S. was on the decline. And I think we kind of needed to send them a message a little bit as well that, hey, we're back. We're of course we'd never left, but we've never left even more. And I think that is probably partly responsible for that announcement aspect, which you're right, you know, then puts a greater onus on us actually to fulfill what it is that we've set out to do.
Yeah, I you know, I was in the Bush administration and the Obama administration, and I would argue that we never really left the region. Certainly we had other things that we were dealing with, the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan and the war on terrorism. But I think we were still committed to the region. And my own sense is, because of my time staying in the Obama administration, my own sense is there was also a political element, domestic political element to the rebalancing, which is to say to the American people, you know, the Bush administration spent a lot of time in parts of the world where outside of the Asia Pacific, you have the 21st century, there's going to be prosperity, which means jobs back home. So I think there was a huge domestic element to it, which then I think led to the fanfare with which it was announced. I think that was more of the domestic piece to it. Would you agree with that?
I think I would say you're in a better position to make that claim, and I don't think it sounds unreasonable to me. It does sound reasonable, but I guess I think that it was also driven by the necessities of the region, the fact that President Obama really does see himself, you know, as having spent all that time in Indonesia, as having a vision for Asia, as having a personal tie to the region that he also wanted to develop. And, you know, there may have also been an element of the fact that, you know, the administration went in, I think, with a very positive attitude about improving relations with China. And that did not come to fruition early on. And his first trip to China was not a big success. And so I think the pivot rebalance is also an acknowledgement that doing business with China, you know, one-on-one was not going to be easy. And again, they were already becoming more assertive. And I think, again, the pivot rebalance sort of addressed those kinds of issues as well.
It sounds to me like we agree on the elements of the rebalance. We agree that, you know, strengthening our alliances, strengthening our diplomatic presence, economic presence, trade presence in the region are all important. I think what we might disagree with is on the tactics of how it was done. And I think that's largely the concerns that I had, but I agree with you. I think we need to put more emphasis in the Asia going forward, and I think the rebalance was a good start at doing that. Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth, for spending time with us today. That's it for this edition of Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site, see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.